Hi, my name is Ben Armstrong.
Hi, this is David Koch.
My name is Thomas Maurer.
Hi, I'm Donna Sarkar.
Hi, my name is Lana Montgomery.
Hi, I'm Seth Warres.
Hi, I'm Aaron Thomas.
I'm Jess Dodson.
Hi, I'm Rocky Heckman.
Hi, I'm Sonia Cuff.
Hi, I'm Troy Hunt.
Hello, this is Wally Mead.
My name is Reid Purvis.
Hi, I'm Lars Finn.
Hi, my name is Alan Birchall.
Hi, I'm Adam Fowler.
Hi, I'm Scott Guthrie, and you're listening to the Need to Know podcast.
All the latest Microsoft Cloud news, as well as industry guest deep dive conversations. It's the Need to Know podcast, all thanks to Rode Microphones. The Need to Know podcast. Catch us on Twitter and Facebook, NGK Podcast, and online at podcasts.needtoknow.cloud.
So welcome along to another Need to Know podcast. This is episode 211. My name is Robert Crane, and I'm actually flying solo for this episode. So here's the big question for everybody out there. Where is Brenton? So what I've done for you, create a bit of interactivity and a bit of fun, I suppose. I've created a forms questionnaire where you can go in and submit what you think may have happened to Brenton for this episode. Now, you'll find that in the following URL. So if you go to bit.ly/whereisBJ and fill in the form there. There are some options that I've suggested to give you some prompts, but there are also an option there for you to suggest something else. So what we'll do is report back next week on what everybody thinks turned out to be the most popular reason that Brenton is not here for this episode. Is it just a one-off, or is it a ongoing situation? Ooh, you'll have to wait and see. So there's a bit of drama, a bit of controversy maybe, and a bit of wondering as to where young BJ is. So again, visit the link bit.ly/whereisBJ and put in your thoughts and what you think's happened to Brenton. I'll make sure that is in the show notes. Now, simply because Brenton isn't here doesn't mean we won't work to give you the information about the Microsoft Cloud, and there certainly has been plenty of it. So probably the biggest one for most partners is the news that Microsoft has rolled back its partner changes. It was announced basically first up at the Inspire Partner Conference in the US. We've got a link in the show notes basically to confirm all that, so you can read that. You can also look at the video from Microsoft announcing that rollback and basically saying that they had heard the feedback from partners. So basically what that means is all the stuff we talked about, the changes, the differences in IUR and the on-prem support incidents being removed. Well, that's not the case anymore. They're back on the cards. So again, feel happy, use those, make sure you make full use of those, and we'll keep an eye on the program to see what happens basically in the coming months in regards to that. Now, there is a nice little inclusion or add-on now for Intune. These are called the security baselines. There are two of these, one for ATP, Defender ATP, and also one for MDM security. Basically, these are Microsoft best practices Intune policies that you can apply directly to your environment, to your devices. Now, I have written a blog post. I ran up against a little bit of a challenge or a bit of a problem when I implemented these myself, because these are additive. So what that means is they will add on top of any existing Intune policies that you may have. Again, you need to be careful about what you do, and I'll make sure I put the link in the show notes to my blog post to give you an idea of some of the troubleshooting I need to do. I had a problem with getting Exchange Online PowerShell to connect with WinRM, so we had to go down and debug that, and that basically turned out to be one of the security baselines causing an issue. Again, I was, I suppose, didn't fully appreciate that they were applying a policy. I thought they were just doing comparison, but it turns out they actually are in implementing a policy, and you need to be careful of the implications that can have. So I'll make sure that the announcement from Microsoft about these policies is in there, plus my blog post to give you a bit more of an idea of how to go about troubleshooting and what's involved and what to be careful for. So make sure you do spend some time looking at that if you're looking to implement these security baselines. I think they're going to be a very simple, easy way to get the security of your devices and your environment up to scratch very, very quickly based on Microsoft best practices. You can go in and modify them to suit your own needs. So I'd certainly be starting there if you want to get your Intune environment up nice and secure very, very quickly. Now, another interesting announcement from Microsoft has been something called Azure Lighthouse. Now, Azure Lighthouse basically is a way for service providers to access client tenants in Azure and allocate permissions and resources to environments in there from a single tenant. So it allows a partner to overwatch, to overlook a number of Azure tenants and provide different levels of permissions and securities for their own technical staff to go and help customers. So one of the big challenges has been with a lot of these multi-tenant environments is how do MSPs, how do service providers manage on behalf of customers. There have been some solutions out there, but they have been a little bit clunky and at times unreliable. Again, what we're seeing is hopefully this Lighthouse from Azure is the first step in that direction. Getting it right looks very powerful, looks to be rewritten from the ground up. Hopefully we'll see the same sort of thing coming to the Microsoft 365 environment as well. So we'll get Microsoft 365 Lighthouse, hopefully. Keep our fingers crossed. But we'll put the link in the show notes so that you can go in and, again, have a look at what Azure Lighthouse is all about. It may not be for you immediately, but hopefully have a look and have a think about what it would be like when it hopefully comes down to Office 365. Now, speaking about Intune, there is also now the ability to roll out control or management of Outlook for iOS and Android in the app configuration area, but not require enrollment. So typically, when you want to manage these areas or these devices, they need to be enrolled, which puts them sort of under company control. That, again, can be a little bit of a challenge for people who don't like to do that on their own personal devices. So we've now got the ability to do that without enrollment. We'll make sure the link is in the show notes so you can go in and dig into that. So if you have the need to have devices controlled in Outlook, iOS and Android, then we can do that now without enrollment, which is pretty cool. Now, another very interesting number that Microsoft recently announced was the fact that Teams usage, daily usage, now exceeds their major competitor being Slack. So Microsoft is quoting around 13 million daily active users, while Slack's last reported numbers are about 10 million. Now, if you look at the graphs of the usage, daily usage, Microsoft's Teams is on a hockey stick like trajectory, whereas Slack is, again, seems to be at a fairly steady and increasing angle. Now, it's very interesting that obviously in a short period of time, Teams has got to that level. But on the other side, obviously, a lot of people who have Office 365 enterprises will take up this product off the bat. So we'll be interested to see where this pans out in the long run. I think that Microsoft, obviously, at the moment is focused on Slack as a competitor. Apparently, they're also very focused on Facebook's work group or their working, their collaboration, their business collaboration environment as well as a major competitor. So we'll see how this pans out and, again, whether they keep trying to peg themselves against these competitors. But obviously, it makes it nice for them to have a mark to shoot for. And according to their stats, they're now in the lead. So, again, if you want to have a look at that, read what Microsoft has said about that. Go and have a look at the link that will be in the show notes. Now, one of my favorite tools or services of late is Microsoft To Do. Really like that, really easy to use. Use it for personal and also for business needs. It integrates with your Outlook, but we're now seeing more and more integration with Planner. So Planner basically is a Trello-style tool, which basically has buckets, and you move your tasks between the buckets simply and easily. It's generally easy to add into a team and makes, you know, basic management very, very simple. So if you haven't looked at Planner, worthwhile, but now we've got the To-Do integration. And To-Do obviously has a free version, but also has a Microsoft Office 365 commercial version that is available as well. So go in and have a look at that. Look at the integration. And again, it's beginning to pan out how Microsoft's thinking about doing task management. Now, it certainly is a challenge. I get many questions from customers about what should we use for task management. There's lots and lots of options. We can start with Outlook tasks, we can do SharePoint tasks, we can do Planner, we can do To-Do. So it's a matter of looking at what suits your needs, where they make the most sense, and there's no downside to using multiple tools, and we're beginning to see more and more integration between these. So hopefully it won't be so difficult to make a choice between these. Now, another interesting point that has recently surfaced after the Inspire conference has been some of the change in licensing around Power Apps and Microsoft Flow, particularly for the standalone plans. Now, there's lots of ifs, thens, and buts, but if you're someone who basically needs Power Apps and Microsoft Flow and uses it regularly, I'd suggest you go in and have a look at the link we've got here or do some searching out there for some of the changes. Apparently, they are going to be enabled or enacted on the 1st of October this year. So again, if you do have a dependency on Power Apps and Microsoft Flow, make sure that you firstly go in and check the show notes for the link there, but also do some research to make sure and see any impact this may have on yourself. Now, finally, one of the improvements or one of the new features that have come to Outlook on iOS and Android is finally the ability to access and configure shared mailboxes. So again, if you go into the app, make sure that you've got the latest version, download it from the store of choice. If you go in and add a mailbox, you should see the option there for a shared mailbox. Now, from what I see, I certainly have it on both my Android and iOS. I have talked to people who haven't as yet seen that, although they have the same version on their mobile devices, so it may be something to do with the tenant. So it is technically rolling out as we speak. So if you haven't got it immediately, firstly, make sure your tenant's on first release, and if it's not, you can certainly upgrade it to that. If still hasn't got it, then again, be a little bit patient because it will obviously roll out to all tenants. So make sure that you go in and check to see whether your Outlook on your mobile device now supports the ability to access shared mailboxes, and that will remove one of the major vulnerabilities that I've pointed out for a long time, the fact that the old way of connecting shared mailbox was using POP or IMAP, and again, basic authentication, all sorts of problems security-wise, vulnerability-wise in that. So again, if you are using shared mailboxes and you want them on mobile devices, make sure you've got the latest app updates, and then go in and configure that. Hopefully you'll be able to do that natively. Now, I've also noticed that on the roadmap, Microsoft has is committing to rolling out private channels in Teams in August. Given that we're almost in August now, this is really good news, exciting news. This means we'll be able to set a channel inside our team where there will be a limited set of users that can be invited into that, which means that, again, within our team, previously everybody was the same level, everybody could see every channel. With private channels, we'll be able to limit access to not only a specific chat, but also to files within that location. And that's a request that many, many people have made. I haven't seen it as yet roll into my tenant. I will certainly let you know as soon as that becomes available, and we'll talk about that and some of the ramifications. But again, just keep your mind on the fact that this will be rolling out in a very short space of time. Again, the roadmap shows that this will be coming to us basically in August. Now, with that, I will give you some contact details, and then I'll hand you off to the interview that I did with Mark Keane. So Mark is on the Azure side working with Microsoft, and we're going to sit down and speak about Azure Storage, give you a bit of a basics and some insight into that. But before that, if you want to keep in touch with everything that's happening there, go to N2K Podcast on Twitter and also on Facebook. You can send an email to feedback@needtoknow.cloud. And again, you can reach me at DirectorCIA on the Twitter. And again, just to follow up, as I said, flying solo this episode. We'll keep the mystery as to what's happened to Brenton. And again, if you want to have your say or raise an opinion or again, share what your thoughts are as to where he has actually ended up, you can do that by going to the link bit.ly/whereisBJ. All right, so bit.ly/bit.ly/whereisBJ. Let me know your thoughts. It'd be really good to, again, get some feedback from people, a bit of fun, and let's see if you can guess correctly what has happened to Brenton. Now, with that, why don't we get into our interview with Mark Keane? I'm joined by returning guest, a returning ex-host. Welcome back, Mark Keane.
Hello, Rob.
It's been a long time. It's taking you a bit of a while to digest that. You're not used to it, I see. So what has Mark Keane been up to since we last spoke? I believe on episode 200, the anniversary issue of the Need to Know podcast. What's been happening with Mark at Microsoft since then?
Lots and lots and lots. In fact, you're right, Rob. You said, like, Microsoft will have a way of keeping you busy. And they do.
Excellent. Well, can you give us a bit more information on what sort of things they keep you busy doing?
A lot of it is just a lot of conversations with customers, pre-sales conversations about various infrastructure, Azure infrastructure conversations and questions about, like, what does what and how to solve what problem with infrastructure with Azure to try and get them to choose us and not the others.
Cool. All right. And again, obviously dealing with lots and lots of customers, big and small. I mean, what are customers typically wanting to do? Move their whole infrastructure to Azure, or is it a hybrid sort of arrangement? What are, you know, what's a typical sort of conversation, if there are any typical ones?
It's a mix and match. So some customers want to do lift and shift. In fact, the whole thing, like data centers coming, the classic data center comes up for renewal, or they want to downsize. They've got two data centers and they want to downsize to one, and they need another one for DR. Then there's an obvious one there. Maybe there's one where they want to sort of move some applications to Azure and some applications to another public cloud for the not the all eggs in one basket type of mentality. Or it could be customers where they've got most of their workloads already in Azure and they want to move more workloads in Azure. It's a whole mix.
Excellent. Well, I think what we'd like to focus on today probably is storage. So storage in Azure is something I think has a lot of call for in many businesses, but also particularly in SMB. So again, for those that aren't aware, we can use a number of different methods for storage within Azure. We've got virtual machines, we've got dedicated blob storage, file storage, and a range of other options. So we thought this would be a good topic to get some deep dive information with Mark around what's on offer and what would work for people. So at a very high level, Mark, you know, what sort of storage options do we have available in Azure?
Lots. Heaps. Lots and lots and lots. When it comes down to it, there's a difference between, because a lot of, like, storage is, everyone needs storage, right? Data is data. But then what do you want to use it for? Is it consumer or is it application? Or is it to support what you've got currently on-prem at the moment? So you might have like a storage solution with a classic Windows file server on-prem. Is it like you don't want to move off that yet? Do you want to do some type of hybrid? Do you want some sort of help to support that, as in data growth? Like, rather than buying heaps of disks, you're running out of room and you want some sort of a tiering type of an option, and also maybe backups are failing because there's so much data and you need some sort of solution to help with backups. Or do you want to move everything across to the cloud? And then you've got choices of whether it's OneDrive or SharePoint document libraries, or whether it's like some other solution, maybe a partner solution.
All right, so why don't we start off with a what-if scenario? So let's say that I'm a customer, SMB-style customer, relatively small, but always have a lot of data. I've got a lot of data in my file server. Again, it's not important, necessarily critical data that I use day-to-day that I would assume goes to Teams or to SharePoint Online. But it's data that I want to keep and maybe access occasionally, or again, use intermittently, but I don't want to obviously delete it or leave it on-prem. Let's say that we've got you know, maybe 2 terabytes worth of that sort of data. What's a good scenario there?
So the classic Windows file server on Premiere?
Yep.
Okay. And 2 terabytes of data, and then you've got users accessing it, and you want to have some sort of tiering on there, and you want something to support that to narrow your footprint or to reduce your footprint on-prem?
Yep.
Okay. So first one is, actually, let me ask another question quickly. Do you have multiple servers or?
No, just a single server. Let's just treat it as a single server. Keep it simple.
Okay. So Azure File Sync would be the solution I would say to go with, because Azure File Sync will complement what you've got without changing what the users see. And so anything behind the server is where Azure File Sync will come in and help. It'll synchronize the data on that server. You basically choose a folder, not a share or a volume. It can be any folder on that server. And you choose that folder, and it'll go and synchronize the data on that server up to Azure File Share or an Azure File Share in Azure. And as well, when you set that up, you give it a percentage of tiering. So it'll ask you a question, how much free space do you want to keep on this server in percentage-wise? So you could have even like a 50 meg drive if you wanted to, reduce it down to that small if you wanted to, and say, look, I want to keep out of my 50 meg drive, I want to keep like 99% free space or 10% free space or whatever you choose. And it'll automatically do the tiering based on that, what you've set. So it'll automatically just in the back end change some files to like stubs on the server side. But then when the user sees it, they'll see just the normal files. So it's even different to OneDrive, how it does its caching or stubs. It's different to that because you know how you got that little icon in Windows Explorer, the little green icon to say it's on the computer and the little empty cloud icon to say
Windows
it's in the
on
cloud?
Demand or yep, files yeah, on demand,
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, so users don't even see that. Like it's just all invisible to the user. So obviously that server would have to have a good, decent connection to the cloud. And then when the user goes and double clicks on a file that's cached, non-cached, it'll automatically bring that file down.
Okay. Now, what about the scenario where I get two users accessing the file at the same time? Is it going to support that? Has it got some sort of locking on it that's any different from what we see on a file server?
That's why I asked how many servers you've got. If it's just a simple file server, and you've got two users accessing the same file at the same time, it'll be exactly the same experience as what you're getting today.
But what happens, because the Azure File Sync, as I understand it, basically will synchronize to an Azure SMB file share in Azure, and that then gives people the opportunity to open that same file directly from Azure rather than from the file server. What happens in that case where we have two people maybe working on the same file? Is that a supported scenario, or is the Azure File Sync really designed to work between multiple on-prem servers?
So I'll tell you what happens. Yes, you can access the same file directly on the Azure side of it. However, it's not recommended. Why is it not recommended is because if you access the file on the Azure file side, it's not going to sync back straight away. So if you add a file to the Azure side of the cloud, we call it the cloud endpoint. If you add a file or make a change on the cloud endpoint side, then that only changes back on-prem every 24 hours. So it's not really recommended. It's not really a solution really to have users accessing both an on-prem server, like the server endpoint and the cloud endpoint together. It's more so for a use case where users still access the server on-prem as they would today, but it's going to save you the hassle of having to deal with data growth because it's got the tiering, and it's going to save you the hassle of backups because it comes with snapshotting, daily snapshots.
And I suppose the other real benefit is if you do have multiple servers, then let's say we have a server in Sydney and a server in Melbourne, and they want to keep the files aligned there, that's where really it's going to start talking to that sort of solution. So again, the SMB file share provides the connectivity between the two remote file servers, which have Azure File Sync, making sure everything's synchronized between them. I mean, is that a better use case?
Yes. So you can have multiple on-prem servers, so multiple server endpoints part of the same sync group. So you can have one in Melbourne, one in Sydney, with the same files. And then if one person makes a change to a file in, say, Melbourne and saves it, then that file is going to appear almost in real time on the server in Sydney. So yes, that's a supported mechanism. Think about it this way. There's also a doc online which also talks about replacing DFS replication with Azure File Sync instead. So keeping the DFS namespace, but turning off DFS replication and having Azure File Sync do the replication instead.
So would you say that Azure File Sync is a replacement for DFS?
Alternative? There's a doc article online.
Okay, so it's an alternative. It's not necessarily a replacement. You just have to work out what your use case needs specifically, but it certainly sounds as though it's giving us that ease of connectivity and the ability to keep our information backed up, but also synchronized between multiple locations, especially in the environment where you want to put the sync engine on the server, whereas the OneDrive client is really designed to be a workstation solution for individual users. So this is, again, more a company solution aimed at being on a server and then obviously synchronizing up to the cloud. Now, are you seeing a lot of uptake with the Azure File Sync? Is this something that a lot of people are beginning to implement because of the flexibility and the options that we've mentioned?
Yes. And the other thing too is it's super, super cheap. So it comes at a cost of Australian dollars, 0.091 cents per gigabyte. Although if you've got an EA in whichever agreement you signed at whatever time, rather than paying the RRP, which is zero, or that's on the online calculator, 0.91 cents per gigabyte, I've seen some customers down at 8 cents per gigabyte based on whatever contract they've got with their EA. So based on that, it's fairly cost effective. Now, on top of that, you've got to think about snapshotting and the retention of your snapshots as well. So it can be fairly expensive, but the other thing as well, we've got to keep or remind customers, hey, this is the cloud. And so rather than having the on-prem mentality where they want to like back up and have a long-term retention of quite a bit of data, because what happens is when it snapshots up in the cloud, it snapshots incremental mode. And so you take a snapshot at that point in time, there's zero cost until there's a rate of change. So pricing is RRP 9 cents per gigabyte is the RRP. I've seen some customers get it cheaper, but based on that fact, the pricing, it's really cost effective. And with the benefits there, they don't have to change what they've got currently at the moment. It comes in the behind the scenes and supports what they've got. Customers or the users still use existing file servers they do today. IT are happy because it takes care of the whole snapshotting and backups and the tiering. We've got like two customers I can think of right now which are actively looking at putting it in. So talking about final numbers and final costs and like starting to do a POC. And getting that underway. So I've got two customers now, and that's looking at, one of them's looking at putting 50 terabytes up there, another customer's looking at putting 12 terabytes up there.
Okay, so that's certainly a lot of data that's going up there. It's sort of a lot that's being managed and put together there. I think that's a great solution for people to consider. There are some limitations, as you've indicated, but especially in multi-site environments, it makes a lot of sense, and with the backup, obviously, SMB files as well makes it very handy, good for an archiving option there as well. All right, so what else is a popular form of storage that you're seeing people adopt out there inside the Azure ecosystem?
There is archive storage as well. So archive storage is more of a, at this stage, more of a manual type of place to put files. When I say manual, currently, the backup products don't support, currently at the moment, it's coming, but they don't support archive storage, but the tiering will be coming for that. But the good thing about archive storage, and if you have a look at the pricing page, comparing the hot storage versus cool storage versus archive storage is like literally dirt cheap. So if you've got a lot of data and you want to like tick the box for compliance, like let's say you've got heaps of data which you hardly ever use and it's just sitting there somewhere in a big chunk of blob somewhere on a server and it's taking up a lot of room, and you've got to keep this data safe and secure for a period of 7 years, it hardly gets accessed. Well, you could easily copy that up to a blob storage account and then turn on archive tiering and then have that sitting on tape, and you can set up LRS or GRS or whichever you like to have that highly available across the region, or across zones, or across the like Sydney and Melbourne, for example, across the regions. It's up to you. So you get a choice of the different availability. But that's also quite a popular one as well, based on the price.
Okay, so you've mentioned there are a number of different tiers, and hot and cool and archive. Can you just give us a bit of a summary as to what they are, what those are, and what the benefits of each are?
So hot is good. It's cheap, the cheapest one for access. So if you want to access your files readily, hot's the best one. But for storage, it comes at a cost. The opposite to that is cool, which is roughly half the cost to store stuff, but it's roughly double the cost of hot to access. So it's sort of the opposite. And then archive is the more extreme of the cool. And archive is even cheaper still, a lot cheaper to store stuff. But if you want to access it, not only does it cost a lot of money, but it also takes a while to rehydrate out of the tape library.
So in essence, what we're saying here is that hot is obviously the more expensive, but the faster access. Cool is cheaper, but the access time, again, is longer. And finally, we have the archive, which is really cheap, but again, the access time is really, really low. And that makes sense, obviously, for long-term retention of data that you want archived. I mean, is that a simple summary?
Yeah.
Excellent. Sounds as though I should work in the job as well. If you've got any issues going forward, make sure you give me a ring. I'm happy to help you, Mark, if you're talking to customers. So apart from those options, what's this thing about blob storage? We hear a lot about blob storage around the place. And, you know, what is it? How can it be used? Where does it fit inside the Azure storage ecosystem?
So blob storage is more so an application type of a mechanism. So blob storage, to get access to it, you need a type of an app like Azure Storage Explorer, Ascopy, or anything like that. You can't really access blob storage directly from a computer, or because you need some sort of protocol. Like, for example, Azure Files, if you look at Azure Files, for example, that sits on top of a blob storage account. But that's like a separate part of the blob storage account where at the platform level, we put on top of it SMB3. On top to get access from a Windows computer or a operating system that supports SMB3. But in the back end, it's all blob storage. Now, in saying that, also on top of blob storage, you've also got like things like managed disks and the Azure Files thing I was talking about, and both managed disks and Azure Files are roughly the same cost. But there's a layer of cost in the middle between blob storage costs and Azure Files, and that layer is because you're paying for that PaaS service, Microsoft putting that layer on top, which is that protocol SMB3.
Okay, so keep going.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, blob storage comes in multiple different flavors. You've got standard tiers and you've got premium tiers. So you've got like standard-based blob storage and you've got premium-based blob storage. And so for each blob storage account, as I said before, like you've got Azure Files, which is part of the blob storage account. Same goes with the tiers with Azure Files. So historically or currently today, Azure Files has been standard tier only. So you set up a standard-based blob storage account and you turn on Azure Files and you can start using that, right? Now, what's happened is Azure Files Premium is now in public preview, and that's out today in a selected number of regions. And Azure Files Premium is the same as Azure Files today, exactly the same. So you can still use Azure Files and whatever else. It's a small Azure Files share. But the difference is it sits on top of SSD rather than spindle disks. So it's a lot quicker. You've got lot higher IOPS, quicker IOPS, lower latency to access it. But it also comes at a slightly higher cost as a result. And to use it, you need minimum 200 terabytes. So you spin up a share. One hundred terabytes is the minimum, and you spin up a 100 terabyte share, and you pay for that up front. So as soon as it's provisioned, you pay for the provision storage. It's like what you do now with managed disks, where you deploy a premium managed disk, like whatever size managed disk you deploy, and you pay for it up front for the provisioning of it. Whereas with Azure File Standard, which is what we're talking about before, you pay for what you use on top of that Azure File Share.
So why is there this difference then? What's the thinking behind that we're paying for all that up front versus paying for what you use? Why is the reason for that?
One is in the back end, obviously it costs a little bit more for SSD versus spindle. But the second thing is Azure Files Premium is more targeted at your serious enterprise workloads. So if you've got a lot of applications within Azure that demand higher capacity and faster performance, then Azure Files Premium is definitely the way to go. But if you're looking at that, and if you actually need those features and requirements, well then having 100 terabytes at a minimum shouldn't be any problem. That should be the minimum to start with anyway. So you can scale up to 100,000 IOPS, target egress rate of 6 gigabits per second, ingress rate of 4 gigabits per second for 100 terabyte shares, and then it goes up in stages after that. So storage and bursting.
Okay, all right. So lots and lots of options with storage. Again, people obviously need to get across how these are configured and what options are available. So again, remember three basic tiers of storage, and then we've also got premium options as well that are available to you. And again, it comes down to capacity, speed versus that sort of cost as well. So remember to keep that in mind. Lots and lots of different places to go in and create storage and use storage in Azure. But probably the easiest way for most people who do have an Azure tenant is to go into storage accounts. Now, storage accounts will allow you to go in and create as many storage accounts as you want. And then basically inside those storage account are the services, blobs, files, tables, and queues. So we've spoken about blobs. We've talked a bit about files, the SMB3 files that make it easy to map a drive to any modern style PC. What's the concept between a table and a queue? Why are they considered storage, Mark?
Because it still sits on a storage account. It's just a different way of accessing the storage account. So table is like key value type of a storage topology, I guess, to say. It sits on top of a storage account and it's dirt cheap. And then queue as well is messaging. So the message itself has to sit somewhere. So storage account is a good place for it. But a comparison to storage queues is service bus. But if you look at the difference between storage queues versus service bus, there's also differences between those two. But again, like service bus more than likely would back on to Azure, the storage underlying mechanism under the covers. But then there's different frills that you get. Likewise, there'll be a different cost associated with it. But what I will actually cover, Rob, as well, is because we've talked about already two different types of SKUs. We've got standard and premium Azure Files and Azure File Sync. And we haven't even touched this. We're about halfway, I would say, about what else is on offer in Azure as far as the storage options are concerned. But you're probably thinking, Rob, like it's already like, holy moly, like which one do I choose? Because you've got so many different options. We talked about price. We talked about the different tiers. We talked about the performance. But then the bit that we haven't covered yet is talking about different protocols. So did you want me to talk about that briefly?
Yep. Since we've mentioned it, why don't we dive into that?
Cool. Okay. So Azure Files, as we said, like SMB v2.1 and 3.0 plus REST coming soon with Azure Files. We'll see at some stage SMB 3.1.1 and NFS 4.1 at some point. Now, we've also got, I don't know if you saw this announcement, but Azure NetApp Files is also here with Azure. And so this is a first-party service, Azure NetApp Files. It's baked into the Azure platform itself. It's a resource provider. If you understand the Azure Resource Manager and resource providers, it's actually a resource provider properly baked into the Azure platform. All the docs for this is not even on the NetApp side. It's on our side. We've got NetApp salespeople have been employed just for this motion itself. And this has been in the making for the last 2 years. They've done it properly and really put this in. So it's definitely, it's not a like NetApp third-party product. It's first-party within Microsoft. So it's one throat to choke pretty much where if you've got a support issue, then you basically go through the portal and log a support ticket like you would normally with any other Azure service. Likewise, if you want to go to deploy Azure NetApp Files, you go through the portal. Currently at the moment, there's a whitelisting process. It's GA, but the whitelisting process is required only at this point for the next couple of months until it ramps up even more so. But Azure NetApp Files is similar to Azure Files, although it's completely different back-end storage. So it's a different storage mechanism. Yes, it's baked into the platform now as it's NetApp technology, but it supports other protocols. So NFS version 3.0, SMB 3.1, and coming soon will be NFS version 4.1 with the security on top. It comes with its own tiers. You've got standard, premium and ultra. It also comes with the good old NetApp technologies and terminology that you're used to hearing. So it comes with capacity pools and volumes. And so for Azure NetApp Files, if you want to set one up, you've got to set up a minimum 4 terabyte provisioned NetApp pool. And then under the pool, then you set up what's called volumes. So you can have a 100 gig volume, a 500 gig volume, or 1 terabyte volume, whatever else. And then if you want more than that, it goes up in 1 terabyte increments after the original or after the initial 4 terabytes. So this is good for like your super, super high performance type of application. So we're looking at applications like SAP, for example, SAP workloads that require NFS storage, your Linux workloads, because historically in Azure, we never really had an enterprise-friendly NFS solution on the platform. Previous to this, the customers had to spin up like a couple of Linux boxes and set up an NFS cluster across the two Linux boxes. But now we've got a serious enterprise-friendly NFS solution on the platform.
Cool. All right. So again, even more options are available. Now, is that GA? Is that available now in the portal?
It's GA now in Sydney. Whitelisting is required. So if you want to jump onto it, you need to go through the whitelisting process, which they'll whitelist, and then you can go through and set that up in the portal.
Cool. And I think the only thing that you said that isn't GA is the premium version of SMB files. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's in preview at the moment. So array of available regions is Australia East is one of them. So if you go today, if you go into the Azure portal, which I did this the other day, and if you go and set up a Azure premium storage account, like you go to the storage account first, and then on top of that storage account, you set up Azure Files, then you'll see a little bracket in preview, and then it'll basically set you up a 100 terabyte Azure FileShare premium. But don't forget to delete that afterwards, because otherwise you'll be charged for that, like even if you haven't stored anything on there, and you'll get bill shot.
Yeah, a bit of a... But again, I think if you want that improved performance, you want that premium result, obviously it's good that Azure is adding those facilities, adding those options for you. Again, start with something that is more basic and then build up to that, have a play with it. Again, see if it suits your needs. And then there is always the ability to ramp that up if you do need to do that. So again, lots of options basically there in storage. So just another quick question is that I noticed that when we set up storage accounts, we're given the option for an account
kind. So we've got something called General Purpose V1, General Purpose V2. Can you give us a bit of an outline as to what are the major differences? Should we always be picking V2? Is there any reason to go to V1?
V1's slightly cheaper, slightly. V2 is better because I'll tell you the big difference is V1, in fact, I don't even know if it supports the different tiers, but I know V2 for sure, where you can actually set tiers on your blobs. So like you can either do it at the container level, the storage level, the whole storage account level, or at a blob level. So what that means is if you go V2 storage account and you have like multiple containers with multiple blobs on there, multiple files, well, then you can set, say, a handful of those files to an archive tier. And then those handful of files will be put onto tape storage. So that's the big benefit.
Okay. Now, again, I think another thing which a lot of people may not be aware of is the fact that you can join your storage accounts, which are effectively a PaaS service, directly to an IaaS solution using these endpoints. So can you give us a bit of an overview or a bit of an idea of what the endpoint is and how we can connect a blob storage account to a network or to our traditional IaaS?
So you're talking about service endpoints with
service
a VNet.
Endpoints, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So today you can set up a storage account and then you can go through the motions. There's a VNet section in there and you can lock that storage account off to a specific VNet. So which means if you've got services within Azure and you want to access that storage account securely within the same VNet, you can basically set this up and it just means that your VMs or your workloads in that virtual network can talk to that storage account. Because by default, storage accounts, when you set them up, they're accessible publicly, right? And a lot of companies probably don't really like the whole public accessibility of a storage account because of, well, obvious reasons. It's on the public internet and it's a public cloud. So once you basically turn on a service endpoint, it just locks it off from the outside world. It puts like a firewall on there and basically associates it with a virtual network. But at the same time, once you've done that, you can configure that firewall or you can tweak it or you can put a rule in there to say, hey, I want to allow access from a specific public IP address on the internet. So for example, if you've got a business on the internet, you still can, if you wanted to, access directly over the internet to that storage account based on a specific IP address or a range of IP addresses. You've got that flexibility of configuring like the firewall on that. Otherwise, by default, it's locked off from the outside world completely. So it comes as an attractive type of a solution for a lot of companies.
So the way that we get to that is if you go into virtual networks, the easiest way is you'll see an option called service endpoints. You select that and then add a service endpoint. Now you can select from a number of services. So these are typically PaaS services. So you can select from things like Event Hub, Key Vault, Service Vault, and you'll see that there is also a storage option there. And that means you can then connect that directly into your VNet, into your subnet there, and that allows your IaaS infrastructure to then go and talk to the PaaS being storage or one of the other options there. So one of the big, I think, flexible options we're seeing here is how we're able to still work with PaaS and to cut the costs down and to use that benefit also integrated with our IaaS. So that's another big benefit, I think, that Azure gives us is that ability to start with our IaaS and then start, again, pulling resources from our PaaS environment and hook that up. Again, that service endpoints and it works really, really well and allows you to get to your storage that you've set up and all the options that we have discussed here. So if we want to monitor our storage, let's say that we want to, again, make sure that we're not filling the thing up or we're getting the performance we want. How do we do that in Azure? We just go to the Azure Monitor. Is that the best option to keep track of, you know, what's happening with our storage?
Correct. Yeah. Azure Monitor is where everything funnels up to and it gives you the ability to create a lot of alerts based on whichever rules that you set on those alerts.
Yeah. So basically, again, another option in the Azure portal, go to Azure Monitor. And in there, you'll see the ability to look at the logs, create alerts, look at metrics. Again, it's a really good, handy tool for all the resources, not only your storage, that will bubble up into a central location, and then again gives you the way to monitor this and keep in touch with how your Azure services are being used. Now, obviously, if you want to keep on top of your costs, there is a cost management and billing option that you can go in there and have a look at. And again, keep tabs on your spending across your storage. So the storage that I use, for example, is I use a recovery services vault to back up using Azure Backup on a regular basis. Many gigs of data in there, and only cost me basically a few bucks a month to, again, have that retention, have that amount of data stored in there. So again, one of the big benefits of using Azure Backup simply is the reduced cost. But remember that you'd also use Azure Storage for things like log analytics. Again, you typically get a free amount of storage per month with a lot of Azure services, but for more than that, you'll need to obviously connect up a storage account. So storage accounts are pretty much the heart and soul of what a lot of resources in Azure do use. Virtual machines use them for hard disk, log analytics use it for their logs, files, SMB files, and so on. So again, it is pretty much the cornerstone, I think, of one of the major services that Azure uses. And hopefully we've got a bit of an idea from Mark there as to what they are, where they fit in, and what sort of options you can use them for. Is there anything else that you'd like to let people know or people should have a look at when it comes to storage in Azure, Mark?
Speaking of recovery vaults, just be cautious. When you set up a recovery vault, out of the box, by default, it's set up for GRS. Now, if you go through the motions too quickly and you just like see GRS there and think, oh yeah, cool, and go next, and start backing up, at this point, there's no way of converting a recovery vault from GRS to LRS. What this means for you is...
Before we do that, can you just define what GRS and LRS, just in case people don't know, for us?
Okay, so GRS, what it means is it's going to keep three copies of the data. It's like a storage account methodology. It's going to keep three copies of the data in the local data center, right? And another three copies in the region pair. So let's say Sydney and Melbourne. Sydney's the primary, or Melbourne could be the primary, whichever you choose. If you say GRS and say, let's say Melbourne, there'll be three copies in the data center in Melbourne and another three copies in the region pair because it's geo-redundant, okay? If you go LRS, it's one step down from that and it's going to be three copies in the local data center and that's it. Now, with GRS, it might sound cool because it's three copies in the local and three copies in the pair, but you're going to be paying for not only the duplicate of storage, you're also going to be paying for egress out of the region. So egress out of the data, out of the Azure region, it adds up quite quickly based on the amount of data that's there. So getting back to what I was saying before, is if you're going to set up a recovery vault within Azure to backup stuff, go for it, but just go slow and check what you're clicking next to. Because we've had customers before who've set up GRS and they want to go back to LRS, but they can't. But the team is looking at fixing that and allowing people to switch. But today, you can't.
Okay. All right. So again, remember that you can also back up your data in there. You can use it for your PaaS services, blob to store data from web. You can use it for SMB files. You can use it to do messaging. So again, very, very key service in there. And as you go and have a look at it, if you have access to your Azure tenant, and obviously remember that our virtual machines are going to be built on that, and there are tiers, there are ways to select between premium and standard offerings that improve performance, but may also come at an additional cost. So again, be aware of that. All of that you can get some idea of in the Azure pricing calculator and again, use the costing management and billing to keep on top of what your storage is actually costing you, because again, it's very easy to potentially run up these costs if you have the premium options set up. So again, I'd like to thank Mark for the time and the information there. Mark, if people want to get in contact with you, follow what you're doing, shout out to you on the internet, how do they do that?
I'll give my Twitter account, which is Mark Keane, MARCKEAN, and that's it.
Excellent. All right. So once again, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Mark, for providing that and coming back and sharing that with us. We'll make sure that we put some information about Azure Storage Account in the show notes for people to follow up with. But with that, again, thanks everybody to listening this episode of the Need to Know podcast.
You have been listening to the Need to Know podcast from CIA Ops. For training on using technologies like SharePoint Online or Office 365, visit www.ciaopsacademy.com. By purchasing from the selection available, you'll be directly supporting this podcast. To provide feedback on this episode, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.